This tape is made at Naval Station San Diego Theater at a meeting of Admiral Zumwalt, Chief of Naval Operations, with area commanding officers and senior staff officers ashore and afloat at 1450 Friday, 16 October 1970.
Carry on, please, gentlemen. It's my pleasure to introduce the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Elmo Zumwalt.
Gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be with you. I'd like to ask for a show of hands as to how many of you have heard me at the morning session. Well, good, that's helpful. There were only a very few, so I won't be boring too many of you. What I want to try to do is talk to you relatively briefly about our situation in the Navy today, and then save as much time as possible for questions, because I'm looking for your frank questions and suggestions as to how to get on with the solution of our problems. I asked to meet with this group of senior officers, commanding officers and staff officers, because of the special responsibilities that you have, and because you represent a group already dedicated to a career, and therefore have a different set of insights than the younger group. What I have been saying to our naval personnel throughout the country is that we face times of great trauma in the years immediately ahead. We are winding down a very unpopular war in Southeast Asia, and this exacerbates the normal post-war reaction that any democratic society has, which expresses itself in two ways: a reluctance to support adequate defense budgets, and a general tendency to denigrate the military and the military career. And we are certainly seeing ample evidence of both phenomena in the United States today. We face a time of great danger in the years immediately ahead, and therefore the solution to our problems is quite critical. This great danger stems from the fact that almost unbelievably rapidly, the Soviet Union, since the missile crisis of 1962, has proceeded to compensate for the two significant weaknesses which required her to back down on that occasion. You'll recall what she was trying to do was to double the megatonnage she could bring to bear upon the United States and to cut the warning time in half because she was so far behind. And caught with her hand in the cookie jar, she faced a roughly 10-to-1 superiority in United States nuclear weapons, and had she been willing to gamble that we wouldn't use them, she found Cuba ringed with conventional naval superiority, which made it impossible for her to get through. And with no alternative, she changed her direction. The Soviet Union then proceeded a frantic construction program and has today achieved strategic nuclear parity and will in the year ahead overtake us and be the superior nation from the standpoint of total missile systems. I personally believe that a state of mutual deterrence will continue even with that lead. However, psychologically, this represents an advantage to her in the political game around the world. At the same time, the Soviet Union proceeded to add to her always powerful Army, Air Force, and submarine fleet a tremendously new and capable surface navy, which, because it came second, has been optimized against ours and is therefore able to give us a very tough time indeed should we become engaged. Now, by every measure of effectiveness that one can lay out, if you plot the Soviet in red and the United States in blue, you'll find that red goes up and blue comes down. And I don't care whose analysts you use, you've got to admit that with the lines going in those directions at some point in the future, and I believe not too distant future, the Soviet Union will have naval superiority. We're doing everything we can to reverse that trend by seeking to awaken the American people, and by our testimony before Congress and by our discussions with the policy level in the executive branch of the government. The very best for which we can hope is budget levels of the type that will come out of the 71 budget now before the Congress, in which they have already reduced $2 billion below the submitted level. We'll probably get some of that back and be down a billion. This means that in addition to the 108 ships that I have had to decommission in just 3.5 months that I've been CNO, we're going to be decommissioning a lot more. And we face a tough choice of priorities. I have decided that the priorities that we must follow are as follows. Number one, to err in favor of the future as opposed to the present. This means continuing the procurement of new ships, aircraft, and weapons systems by reducing force levels, giving up the older ships. It means an increasing percentage of our lesser budget devoted to research and development in order to ensure that we have a wider choice of options against from which to select when the time comes that the American people are ready to support larger budgets. It means more emphasis on those kinds of things which may help us with lesser force levels to still win, as the cracking of the Japanese codes in World War II made it possible to win the Battle of Midway with lesser force levels. Those kinds of things are more emphasis on electronics warfare, command and control, surveillance, and reconnaissance. The kinds of investments which are, in comparison to shipbuilding costs, relatively low cost and for which the payoff can be very high. Finally, and most important, and the one with which you've seen the most public demonstration of emphasis, is my desire to concentrate very, very heavily in favor of people as opposed to things. And there we are in the process daily of giving up additional ships, giving up military construction for support of readiness facilities or training facilities in order to get money that we can apply to personnel support and personnel facilities. And I propose to continue this trend. I think that the retention rates of officers and enlisted men are so catastrophic at the present time that only by this kind of forced reordering of priorities at the cost of a temporary drop in readiness can we achieve the turnaround in personnel retention which will give us, over the long haul, greater readiness. Now, I have disseminated a relatively large number of Z-grams. I don't intend to stand up here before you and tell you that these are the panacea, and I most specifically am aware of the fact that it's impossible to direct from Washington the kinds of improvements that are necessary unless the commanding officers and senior officers who must implement them are really behind it. The question has been asked, and it's a good one, whether or not these Z-grams don't impinge upon command authority. And I think the answer to that is yes, they do. But these Z-grams represent programs which, in essence, have been selected from, a large number of cases, those ships whose commanding officers have had the most success in retention rates, reenlistment rates, and in the creation of an environment in which there is the kind of esprit that leads the wardroom and crew to feel that they've got a real team, and that when they have finished a hard day, a hard exercise, or a hard deployment, they've had a damn good time as well as a lot of hard work. Second, I would like to emphasize that there are absolutely no constraints on commanding officers to do more than has been directed. There is a whole vast field for initiative and innovative procedures tailored to your particular ship, your particular position in the cycle, the age of your particular ship, the length of time you've been out of overhaul, whether or not you have a high or a low percentage of petty officers, and so forth. So I feel that there is still a dramatic amount of opportunity for initiative on the part of commanding officers. Now, what I have to say very frankly to you is that there is a body of evidence to support the fact that I will guess 70% of the commanding officers are strongly behind the program, disseminate the information in these Z-grams or post them, and proceed to do their damnedest to implement them. I have to further say that there appears to be on the order of 10%, maybe 15%, who are relatively neutral and are letting nature take its course, and that there is another 15 or 20% who are in active opposition to some or all of the Z-grams. I can cite two specific cases, fortunately from the Atlantic Fleet, of one ship on which a member, from which a member came to one of our retention meetings in Washington and stood up and made the statement that he had never heard of a Z-gram until he came to Washington. He had never seen one posted, and after having read what was in them, he could state that not one of them had been implemented on his ship. I can report to you another ship in the Atlantic whose commanding officer said, in essence, the CNO has made his decision on hair, now let him enforce it, and proceeded to restrict to the ship for 30 days anyone who started to comply, and to make sure they were on board, saw to it that they were mustered a number of times every day. This is the very occasional example. I'm sure there's not more than 1% of that category. But the purpose that I have in mind today, and the area to which I hope you will focus your questions, is to have some good, hard discussion on those aspects of what we're doing that disturb you. I'm confident that there couldn't be 15 or 20% in active opposition unless there were sincere reservations about some of these programs. And I hope that you will not hesitate to ask questions or believe that the asking of them categorizes you as a member of that 15 or 20%. I promise not to take names or signal numbers, and I am sincerely here in an effort to learn from you and also to get your ideas as to what more might be done, because I do intend to continue to proceed in the general direction spelled out in the series of Z-grams to date. Gentlemen, who would like to start off? Yes.
Quarterdeck watch standing. And I'm sure that it wasn't your intention, Admiral, in this message to degrade in any way the officer of the deck in port watch. But I have a feeling that there's that's a partial reaction to that message. In some of my conversations with some of my chief petty officers, I get the impression that they feel that that job is now being relegated to junior and experienced officers and senior petty officers, which seems to be a rather unfortunate combination. I'm sure this was not your intention. Have you had any other reaction along these lines?
Yes, this is a good question, one that has come up in two other discussions, and I think I think you're accurate that there is enough data to support the fact that that impression has been given, and I think therefore that this may be one in which I have erred. My general approach to management has been, if there's uncertainty, change it. You'll find out if it's wrong. And there are always 1,000 people who can tell you not to do it. In this particular case, what we were seeking to do was to emphasize my general philosophy that we need to delegate authority and responsibility down as far as possible. I do think it's important that there be a distinction in the level of responsibilities associated with officers and enlisted. My desire here was to make the officer of the deck qualification one to which junior officers aspired and got, and then from which they were removed, and one which petty officers were given as a way of upgrading the responsibilities associated with their level. Now, one additional difficulty that has been reported in connection with this is that the pulling of petty officers off of other watches in order to replace officers at the quarterdeck means that it's more difficult for you to get to your 1 in 6, that you're pulling key petty officers off of engineering watches or other types of watches, and that you just don't have enough petty officers on many ships. And so I think it's going to be necessary for me to come out and spell out the fact that nothing in number 44 should be taken to interfere with the higher priority objective of doing everything we can to get to the 1 in 6. And this may, in some ships, then require a backing away from the watch standing directive. We're going to have to try to make it clear that the purpose is not to denigrate that watch, but to give a very responsible watch to lower ranking officers and to petty officers. Now, there is no reason why the officer of the deck need be the very senior chief petty officers. They can be petty officers first class or second class on those ships where you can afford to do so without hazarding your efforts to get to the 1 in 6. But the frank answer to your question is that isn't a good criticism, and we must try to address it. Yes.
Advancing those petty officers who have failed the written examination based on merit and performance. And the question stems from the fact that we are looking for an individual in the senior grades who is first of all a good petty officer and secondly a good technician. It would seem that if a man, particularly at the first class level, has a hang-up and cannot take the exam, there is something lacking in his makeup. And I would wonder whether or not he would be the individual we would want to see later as a chief petty officer responsible for across-the-board techniques. The same question arises in a different way as relating to the advancement of third-class petty officers directly from Class A school under the current experimental program. Without a chance for commanding officers to evaluate these people under a working environment, which includes not only their technical rate, but also in things that a seaman should be able to do. And at the moment, I've had considerable discussion with my own chief petty officers particularly, and quite frankly, I'm against the stops in trying to justify both of these programs as being pointed towards developing the type of hardcore petty officer we're looking for in the Navy of the future.
Well, with regard to the first issue, if you have honest reservations about whether the category you've described should be promoted, he won't be promoted because it's your recommendation that's necessary in order for him to be one of that very, very small percentage, less than half of a percent, who will be promoted without ever having passed an exam. The recommendation came from the fact that numbers of commanding officers to whom I have spoken, and in my own experience, I as a commanding officer have seen a very few petty officers who just couldn't pass a written examination and yet who knew their subject, could teach their subject, were fine technicians and were outstanding leaders. The purpose here is to give a very, very small escape clause to a very, very small number, only those recommended by the commanding officer, and then having been rescreened and selected at a higher level, so that I feel that the safeguards are quite adequate and that the numbers are so minimal that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. With regard to the promotion of a third class directly from Class A school, this is of course an age-old problem of do you get them up there where the pay constitutes an inducement and a motivation, or do you require that they become petty officers in fact as well as in name? On that, I'd appreciate a showing of hands as to how many commanding officers think that it is wrong for us to be following this route, and how many of you favor the procedure. Well, it's about 60 in favor and 40 against, and I think that indicates that it's probably one that we ought to continue to do and watch. Many of these programs are of a pilot nature. All of them are subject to reversal if we find upon further analysis that they're having counterproductive effects. But as I say, we are looking for every way to further enhance the naval career and the pay and perquisites that go with it. Yes.
And it's on telephones and vehicles. I don't personally think any other multi-million dollar corporation has to do business like a bicycle shop in these two areas. I think we've got a great many man hours, particularly on a large naval base, spent merely trying to communicate with the shore establishment, and if one can then communicate, go to see or pick up and return. In many cases, it's strictly walking and spending a great deal of man hours doing this. I think this area could be hopefully looked at.
We we do propose to get into that area. I couldn't agree more that it's just infuriating to have a multi-million dollar ship and Mickey Mouse transportation and communication facilities. Yes.
I'm Dodd, Commander Coastal Squadron 3. I'd like to recommend, Admiral, that we have more stringent criteria for enlisting men into the Navy, and I refer particularly to some form of mental screening for those people who obviously are misfits. And I base these remarks on my particular experience during the past month. I have processed 4 people out of my command for administrative type discharge due to psychiatric problems, and these men have all had less than a year in the Navy. It's extremely unproductive to train these men, send them to A school, and then have to get rid of them.
I agree very wholeheartedly with that, Skipper. I can't be bold in stating we're going to correct it. We are doing some things that will help. We're increasing the number of recruiters, hopefully, so that there can be a little more precision in selection of individuals. The real problem with regard to screening these people out is that they're all given examinations at the Armed Force Examination Stations, where the Army has inadequate numbers of medicos to really do the job, and many of those are not trained psychiatrists. And it's one of those machine processing things, or production line processes, where people are ground out very fast. I'm sure that one could prove that it would be much more cost effective to spend some money to weed those kinds of people out rather than have to go through the process that you've just described. We'll continue to try to work on it from the Washington area, but it's one in which progress will be very gradual indeed. Part of our problem is that, as you know, we are required by national policy to take each of the services a certain percentage of mental group 4s, and in the case of mental group 4s, it's very hard to perceive from their answers whether they're a psychiatric problem or not. We have been able to get the percentage that we're required to take reduced from 18 to 12, and we're working now to try to get it reduced from 12 down to 6. I'm not optimistic, but I intend to keep driving on that. In the rear.
Admiral, has there been any consideration given to the timing of the Z-grams? I'm sure that there have, but on small commands, we're frankly very flooded with Z-grams, and it's hard to get them implemented. You would get one started towards implementation, and here comes another one. If perhaps they were a little slower, why, we could we could implement them a little better. But right now, with a 1 and 6, we go into a 1 and 6, and my particular ship, we're faced with getting ready for refresher training, and then we go into refresher training, and to even get ready for refresher training on a 1 and 6, when we're short 23 people on the ship to start with, is pretty difficult.
People have been telling me to slow down all my life, and I've learned to smile when they say it. I think it is a justifiable criticism that there have been a large number of these, and if you think you've been flooded, you should see my poor staff in Washington who has to deal with the rest of that iceberg, the hundreds of questions that have to get answered, out of which only some get implemented. With regard to that specific one that you cite, let me say that what I have tried very hard to put across to the fleet commanders, the flag officers, in all of my talks and in the personal letters I have written, is that I propose to accept the responsibility for the reduced readiness that I know comes about as the result of the implementation of these Z-grams. In other words, I expect and anticipate that the ships which leave the First Fleet to deploy to the Seventh Fleet will be less ready by some significant factor than they were before these kinds of things were implemented. And I know that we will experience some damage that we wouldn't otherwise have had to our ships as a result of the less quality with a larger number of watches. And I know that we'll have some hull damage due to the bumper drill, which is so important if you're going to really motivate your JOs. And all of this I am prepared to accept and state is my responsibility in order to get the long-term benefits that we can achieve if we do these things, which make it possible for a man to have a respectable amount of time at home on sea duty. I can still remember how rough I thought a 1 in 3 was when I was on it, and how much difference that made to me after a long deployment to still be on a 1 in 3 when I got back. And I think all those of you here have been through it and recall too. And I'm just convinced that this is one of a host of things which put together can have the kind of impact that will help us to turn this catastrophic retention problem around. If we don't, all of the efforts of all of the ships to get ready to deploy is going to be to relatively no avail. We're just not going to have the competence to keep these ships operating. At the present time, the first-term reenlistment rates on Atlantic Fleet carriers is 3% instead of the 35% we need. We're running right down almost to zero. Yes, in the center.
Admiral Lieutenant Martin, CO Chihalo, sir. I have a rather unique situation aboard in that all but four of my people are career motivated. And we have spent, I think, considerable time both implementing the Z-grams and discussing them. We understand the retention problems and the motivation of the Z-grams, etc. The thing that we, during our discussions, continually come back to is that accepting the present reduction in readiness to increase retention and so on, where do we get, or where do we lead and become 6, 8, and 10 years from now with this, with the Z-grams doing more to implement the retention? Are we, in essence, reducing our standards that we who are career motivated and have been brought along the last 8, 10, 15 years to expect? Are we reducing our standards to the point that in 8 or 10 years from now we will be hurting ourselves more than we are now, sir?
Well, this is a good, honest question. We have to trod a very careful line, in my judgment, between making those changes which are non-substantive and about which our younger generation feels very deeply, and retaining those customs and traditions which are important and imperative to the maintenance of good order and discipline. Now, the thing that is impressive to me as I look at these various ideas in the Seagrams is that a very, very large number of them represent things that outstanding commanding officers who have good, successful ships, mission capable and happy, are doing. Therefore, I'm willing to gamble that 6 to 8 years from now, if everybody is doing them, we will not have a bad situation, and in fact we'll have retained so much better quality personnel that the overall situation will be better. In a given port, destroyers side by side, one commanding officer interprets uniform is optional, as disseminated by SOPA, to mean that, and his crew goes ashore. Those who are fat and warm-blooded wear whites, and those who are skinny and cold-blooded wear blues. The next ship to it, the commanding officer says, optional means my option, goddammit. You all go ashore in blues. That's the kind of thing which is infuriating to the average young man. It's the kind of inconsistency between ships of the same type in the same nest that is infuriating. It is the kind of thing that makes it very, very difficult for us to convince young officers, bright, talented, looking for a challenging career, that they want to be in an organization where there can be that kind of a dichotomy and where a commanding officer, out of sheer insistence on his own perquisites, makes interpretations that are unfair to his crew. Now, that's an easy one to pick out, I realize, and we could discuss others in which it would be much tougher for me to make the case, but the warp and woof of what I'm after, I do believe, is proper. As we've discovered here, we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to have to back away from some of them. And I hope we'll discover some more in the discussions. Yes.
Admiral, my name is Graham. I'm from the amphibious base. Most of us here grew up under courts and boards, at least initially. And I don't know that my remarks now are going to apply across the board, and I don't know how they apply to the ships at sea. I haven't been there for a year, and there have been significant changes made in the last year. I want to address the legal problem. Now, we've seen a time when the convening authority convened a summary or a special court-martial, and he did it one day and it was held the next. This is no longer true. We've seen a time when Bucyrse came out with some administrative procedure and you went in a couple of days and got all of the paperwork together and shipped it off to Bucyrse. You got a decision, you came back, the decision was made. You took the necessary personnel actions. This is no longer true. Today, if you give a special court-martial, you get the necessary, the convening authority says convene the special court-martial, then you go somewhere in the district and ask for a judge and a couple of qualified lawyers. If they were readily available, I could go back to the old system and do it tomorrow, but they're not readily available. It started out there were 3 weeks, and now there's 6 weeks, if you're lucky. Sometimes 6 weeks. Well, who do you hold? You hold the accused and all the witnesses involved. If you transfer them, and during the course of the court-martial, which is to follow some 6 weeks later, you may have to bring them back. This is of great concern to me. I have as many as 1,500 students in their last duty station before going to Vietnam, and some of them make up their mind they'd rather not go, and then as a result, there is some disciplinary action which must be taken. Also, a prime example of the administrative procedures is the conscientious objector route. I now have one officer who, after the local federal judge said that he should carry out his orders, appealed it to the Court of Appeals. I have another officer who's still at the local federal judge level, and I have another officer who's going to be there in a very few days. This is taking an awful lot of time, and more it seems to me that our administrative procedures are being tied up legally, and they are no longer administrative procedures. They're legal procedures today. The same thing applies to field boards for various methods of discharge under Bupers Manual. At one time, you could do it within your own command, but it's difficult to do it anymore if the individual involved wants to pursue it in that terms. I'm very much concerned about the 5% who take 95% of your time on board a ship from a legal standpoint. I don't know what we can do about it. Maybe it's bigger than the Navy, but it is a problem, and in my estimation, it's growing.
You've made a very good point, one of which I'm very conscious. You are accurate that it's a bigger problem than the Navy. It stems from the continual liberalization on the part of the courts and within the Congress of our approach to military justice. It's part of the general revulsion with the military, of which I have spoken, but it goes beyond that. It also has to do with the increasing emphasis on finding ways to protect the accused at the expense of society. I'm not sanguine that we can do major surgery to correct this, but I have received sufficiently strong expressions of concern about it on this trip that I will, when I get back to Washington, again raise the issue with our Secretary of the Navy and Secretary of Defense and try to get them to understand the extent to which this is posing severe hardships on the commanding officer. Meanwhile, although this won't come as a panacea to you, we do hope to improve the situation for ships by making it possible for them to streamline their procedures by getting a man ashore where the shore activities will have to live with it. Yes, in the far.
I'm Captain Cease from the Navy Preventive Medicine Unit, and it's true that inconsistencies are deadly as far as morale is concerned. I haven't seen a Z-gram on Operation, what am I trying to think of? I've drawn a blank here. As they're phasing out, as men retire or leave the service, what am I trying to think of? Operation Transition, right. A small unit such as I have, alongside of a larger unit, chiefs with 20 years, 30 years, 90 days ahead of time, they're out learning to be real estate salesmen, getting paid by the Navy and by another activity. The younger men see this. Mine, I get down to Catch 22, which says if the mission allows them to be spared. It doesn't, because each one of them is a specialist in his own field and is holding down part of a department. It seems this inconsistency should be solved at a higher level. Perhaps a relief could come if a man says, makes known his desire to partake in the operation. Perhaps the relief could get there 3 months early. I don't know, but I do know that it makes real feeling, and also the younger men see this and feel that they'll be in that position someday, so perhaps not, it's not as rosy as the Z-grams might make it out to be occasionally.
Well, one part of that puzzles me. I should think that the young man, seeing a man getting an opportunity to go through Project Transition at the end of his 20 years, would think that that's good, that he too would have his opportunity.
If he gets the opportunity. If he's not in a small activity where he cannot be spared for the 90 days prior to his discharge.
It's being done differently by different activities.
Exactly.
Right, it is a valid point, and one that I ought to take up with my staff.
A large activity of 1,000 men can spare one or two men who are up for their 20 or 30 retirement. A small activity where I have 13 or 14 men, and they're all key men in different departments, I can't spare them until a relief comes.
It's one that I'll take back to look into.
Thank you, sir.
I would agree that the procedure ought to be standard. I suspect that the solution to it, however, would be one that would not be welcome to you, and that would be that we would have to direct that all activities do it. It is, I think, something that is a right and something that our senior people ought to be able to count on. Now, maybe the way we do it is to see to it that as men approach that part of their career, they're attached to larger activities. There are maybe ways to minimize the impact on very small activities.
I would welcome anything that would standardize it, but when I have the responsibility of running a unit and cannot run it shorthanded, it is still my responsibility to keep people there to run it until such time as they're relieved.
Right.
I'm not relieved of my responsibility. If you relieve me of that and say, 90 days before everyone goes, great.
Then
we're going to run it shorthanded and do the best we can.
Right. This I am prepared to do as I'm doing in other cases where I accept the consequences of the reduced readiness. In the center here.
Admiral, I'm Lieutenant Sequist, commanding officer of the USS Beacon. I'd like to address a question to you concerning stabilized crewing. I feel that a number of our problems, not only in personnel retention, but in the quality of performance by our ships, would be solved if we could simply put one crew on a ship and within reasonable limits leave that crew on there for 18 months to 24 months. Right now we have such high turnovers that our personnel services from the personnel offices are poor due to overloading. The actual training skills acquired by the ship with high personnel turnovers never turns out to be very great, so that the esprit of a command never reaches what we would expect it to be as a combat-ready Navy vessel. And I'm suggesting that what seems to be a fairly simple task of putting a crew aboard a ship and leaving them for 24 months could be done.
We are looking at that one very hard. What the analysis appears to indicate at the present time is that in order to do it with the tremendous amount of losses and gains that we have, one would have to accept significant differences in manning levels within ships. In other words, one ship might have 20% less than another as you froze both of them and waited for new gains. I think there is the prospect that we'll be doing something along this line. The new commander of the Atlantic Fleet, Admiral Duncan, who has just left the job of Chief of Naval Personnel, is personally quite interested in this and thinks he can make it work, although he does recognize that there are going to be significant differences among ships, and this will cause a different set of problems. What I'd like to ask now is if there are any comments or suggestions that you would like to make that deal with the following. What more can be done to ease the load on you commanding officers so that you are able to devote more time to personalized attention to your officers, crew, and their problems, and so that you yourselves are enjoying your command, as we ought to be able to do. Yes?
Well, Admiral, I'm happy to report, thank goodness, that I'm a member of the silent majority. I think the programs we've had to date for increasing the zest of going to sea are just great, and it's been long overdue. I do note, however, that our programs to date are mostly oriented toward improving the morale and so-called happiness of the junior officers. I think what we really need to do is have a campaign to improve the morale and happiness of the captains. I have 3 points in mind specifically. I think what we really need to do is, first of all, start trusting our captains a little more. We frequently investigate at the drop of a hat. I myself, in my last command, was investigated 4 times and came out clean 4 times, but 3 of these times they were things that I was not personally involved in. I would like to see our investigations just limited to those from outside authority in which the captain has a personal role. I think if he has an engineering casualty, for example, he has every right to assume that the problem lies in the engineering department. Let him investigate and let him report to the type commander what his findings were. I also find that in my particular situation, we're working up for deployment. And we have a set of inspections that are really dreadful for the skippers to carry out. We have ORIs, we have various departmental inspections, and it all had to be done in a very short period of time. I think if we could change our inspections and get it out of the evaluation of the captain's performance concept or frame of mind, and get it into a consultative frame of mind where a captain could send for the same inspection group to come down, inspect his ship, and make his report to the captain, we could relieve a lot of pressure and perhaps get started on a happier ship.
I think those are both good suggestions, and I would support both of them. We have a paper in staffing right now which seeks to find better ways to do the evaluation process and to avoid the formality and the trauma that a crew and a commanding officer go through when they know there's a deadline for a group of people to come aboard and, like a Gestapo, work them over. One of the things that we're looking at very hard is whether it ought not to be possible for all except those inspections that are required by law, the inspection, the in-serve thing, to just require that the unit commanders at unannounced times drift aboard and get a general feel for the ship as a visitation process. No checkoff lists, no red lead being slapped on hastily at the last minute, but just to get a feeling at random times throughout the year as to how the ship is doing, and get acquainted with the ship and see what he can do to be helpful. I believe that there has been a significant improvement in the last 2 or 3 years on the investigative issue, and that more and more commanding officers are being permitted to initiate their own, but this is one concerning which I would be happy to initiate as EGRAM, and the campaign to improve the zest and happiness of commanding officers is one of the reasons I'm here today. Let me have some more of your suggestions. Yes.
And the Marine Major, who is a field grade and wears scrambled eggs and so forth, and the Navy Lieutenant Commander, I think, needs some support in consideration of the CNO and the DOD level.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. I broaden the general problem, I think, to one of trying to get responsibility and perquisites down at each grade. But I think the lieutenant commanders coming in between the old FUD and young stud category are a special breed that needs some consideration. Yes, Paul.
Admiral, I'd like to shift gears a little in relation to this audience here. With what you said initially when you opened your remarks about reducing the size of the Navy for a future lean, hungry group, what are the command potential or possibilities of this group here? I understand that 2-year tours are in the mill, and 1 year, one tour at sea for captains is a possibility. Could you comment on this, please?
Yes, we're looking at a host of questions One thing that does seem to be quite clear is that the extra stability that a ship gets from having a skipper for 2 years is an important and meaningful thing for the wardroom and crew. And so I do favor the longer tours. At the same time, we're also looking at two other categories of major commands. One is to make an honest commitment that commands of naval air stations and naval stations have equal weight and indeed other places, for example, recruit training centers, have equal weight with seagoing commands, and to assign a cross-section of talent to both the sea and the shore commands. The second category is to make an honest commitment that project managerships and other technical managerships ashore have and equate to the responsibility of a seagoing command. What this means then is that one can visualize several different career routes. You can visualize those who remain generalists going from sea to shore throughout. You can visualize those who specialize in a given area ashore and go to sea and continue all the way to flag rank back and forth, but always in the same area of specialization, and who do their final major command in a project managership. And you can visualize those who break off after maybe only a commander's tour at sea, and by choice then stay in a technical role in shore responsibilities and still make flag rank. I believe that we can do this, and I believe we have to do it. The present administration, especially Mr. Packard, our Deputy Secretary of Defense, who is an outstanding business manager himself, believes that the services will never do it. He's willing to give us a chance to prove it, and the consequences of not doing so are that we could expect to have more and more of our technical management done by civilians. And I think, therefore, that it's very important for us to adjust to this and to give an honest career route through those three tracks I've discussed. Yes, in the aisle.
Admiral, I dislike to take opposition to some of your statements. I wish, from a medical point of view, that we lived in this grand world of a Shangri-La, a utopia, where every one of our men had individual initiative, an individual sense of responsibility, boundless energy, optimism, and could accomplish all these things without guidance, and maybe without some formalized type of inspections. However, I believe, like Socrates, that from time to time, it is necessary for the Socratic gnatfly to sting and awaken the sleeping Socratic horse. Medically speaking, throughout operational medicine, we do not have the luxury to follow many of your Z-grams and come out with good results. We go, in my particular case, from the rank of captain and Commander Wenger on the staff, down to the rank of a lieutenant, a man who had just come into the Navy. Now, we do not expect our doctors, when they first come into the Navy, to really know anything about the Navy or to know anything about naval administration. I one time heard one of our famous admirals excuse an ensign who just graduated from the academy. He spent 4 years in the academy. He said, "What do you expect? He's just an ensign, and he can't find his behind with a working party of 12 men. But now, how can we expect our young doctors to know very much about administration when they first come into the Navy? So therefore, with the pyramid system that we now have set up in inspection and medicine, these young doctors go about, inspect each other, and it's the blind leading the blind. They're non-informed, they're non-knowledgeable, they don't know what they're looking at, and the inspection is totally meaningless. As a particular example of that, I refer to my good friend Commodore that just got up and made a few remarks earlier, Tracy Wilder. I inspected his ship, the Iwo Jima. The first time in my experience has been the most outstanding ship we've had in the Pacific Fleet. It's now the worst. Under this new system, whereby formalized inspections no longer carry any weight. It's just like my boy who was a straight-A student and he didn't care about library. He got a B and found out he was not on a straight-A honor roll because the library counted. So therefore, he had to pay attention to library. I asked his squadron medical officer. He didn't even know he was a squadron medical officer. This reminds me of Yale Medical School, where once you get into Yale, you're so outstanding that they feel you no longer need an examination. All you have to do is live 4 years, pay your tuition, and you get an MD degree. I haven't seen yet one medical student that graduated from Yale who was worth a damn as an intern. So I must say that medically, I don't think we can afford this luxury. And that is my comment, unless we have greater reinforcement, a greater filtration system to make this pyramid system effective, and people with these type of qualities of willingness.
Yes.
What I'd like to ask you to do, Doctor, knowing the high quality of your work from a doctor who is very near and dear to me, is to put down your specific recommendations as to what ought to be done to correct this situation and mail them off to me as a personal letter. Yes, here in the middle.
Captain Herzog, Comdesron 1. With the statement by Mr. Laird that by fiscal year 73 there will be no more draft, and with the withdrawal of Vietnam cutting down on the draft calls, has there been any study made as to what we can expect as initial input, what the impact is going to be on our initial input into the Navy from which we're to draw the retention?
There's been a great deal of painstaking looking at the problem. The service chiefs of staff are all unanimous that the expiration of the draft next June 30th would be a disaster for the country, and that the services would all rapidly run down to a population that would encourage the Russians to move right out rapidly. We all know that it's the Army-inspired draft that keeps the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Air Force filled with volunteers. The action that is going to be supported by the Department of Defense is to try very hard to persuade Congress to extend the draft legislation. We probably will have to accept a 2-year extension and then go all out to try to achieve the all-volunteer force by June 30, 1973. Mr. Laird has just announced a vigorous campaign to get cracking with this, and the Army has enunciated a program that they propose to follow. They consulted with our Z-Gram shop in great length before proposing theirs. We know that we're going to have to do some heroic things. Increasing the recruiters was one that we already are trying to do. We probably are going to have to use special interest groups to attract special interest groups. That is, to get a field of civilian specialists to work on a certain group of personnel that might be oriented toward that skill. We may even need to seek help from civilian advertising agencies. All of the services are looking at this thing from stem to stern. The most important and overriding consideration, and the one without which it will surely fail, is to get the all-volunteer force pay scales, much increased pay scales at all levels. Without that, all the rest is just going to be hustle and bustle. There's going to be quite an effort on the part of the Department of Defense to get these pay scales. Gentlemen, we've come to the end of the allotted time. Is the commanding officer of the Ticonderoga here? If he is, would he please stand up? Oh, let's see. Well, let me say I regret that, because I just wanted to report to you all that based on the mass of information coming in to Washington through personal letters to Chief Black, letters to the Bureau of Naval Personnel, and a myriad of other ways, I get the impression that the Ticonderoga has done a most impressive job of really implementing a series of programs that are having a significant impact on their crew. And I commend his specifics to you if you have the opportunity to discuss it with him. I also know that a very, very large percentage of you here are vigorously working on these projects of mine and others, better and more imaginative of your own selection and choosing. What I have to say in conclusion is that we're embarked on something that just simply must not fail. I must have your total and complete support. I know that I can count on getting it. I know that each of you can figure out better ways to get done the primary objective that I have in all that has been disseminated, and that objective is to improve the lot of the individual from the commanding officer on down, to remove the unnecessary part of the load in order that he can do